Everybody to inner city left discussion. My name is Amin TMK, and I'm excited that we can start the show. I'm going to jump right into it if that's cool with everyone.
And I'm a Loja, little tanky Sumler.
Thanks for jumping in and introducing yourself. you can always find us on inner city left on Instagram, where we post all the time. With that being said, Amoja, let's talk a little bit about, well, let's talk a lot of bit about Palestine. There's a lot to discuss. Yesterday, it looks like the IDF has decided to go into Rafah. I was watching a video earlier today of a tank shooting a refugee tent in Rafah. What are Palestinians supposed to do now, and what are the consequences of what it looks like is a full invasion of Rafah possibly on the way?
I mean, regardless as to what they should do, what they're going to do is resist, right? I mean, and that's guaranteed under the United Nations Convention of Oppressed People in a Conflict Zone, right? So these are the things that when we talk about rule of law, like these are the laws. These are the laws that exist. It's very hard to make an argument for why people like the Ukrainians have an inherent right to resist and then dismiss those arguments against the Palestinians. Now, what you're still dealing with is the law of force, right? Even though those people will resist, the Palestinians will resist with the powers that are afforded to them. The Ukrainians will resist with the power afforded them. They're up against the same problem. You're up against a military force that is more organized, more professional, and at least nominally better stockpiled. You know what I'm saying? So, again, for both of these countries, you have the same kind of problem. Without external help, the resolution is you already know what's going to happen, right? When the people with bigger guns go up against the people with smaller guns or no guns, also that haven't drank water, haven't had food, haven't slept properly, are shell-shocked, unrefreshed, right? The problems that face the Palestinian resistance are the exact same problems that face the Ukrainian resistance. The irony is the reasons are how we got to resistance. That's, I would say, the biggest difference between those two.
It seems like I don't know, ability for politicians to sort of remain diplomatic is sort of begun to erode. And I think we're starting to see that more with the rhetoric coming out. I wanted to ask you, you know, we see in the protests happen here in the United States. I was watching one that was a protest against the Rishi Sunak. I've been seeing protests all over. I'm wondering what is the reaction of, you know, the rest of the world in terms of what's happening right now with free speech, all of that. What is there something? I hate to say this because I always feel like my dad or other people were always like, oh, this is one of the most important times. This is one of the most important times. But it really feels like this moment is just one of the most important times in history. What are your thoughts on that?
100%, right? The thing to remember is when you're talking about the politicians is war is a continuation of politics through other means, right? Where there is a war that happened, there is a political agenda that is at work. I mean, it's worse than you even thought, right? If there isn't politics behind a war, then really, truly, all is lost for humanity, right? So what you have to do then is look at what are the politics that are driving these wars, you know what I'm saying? So when you're dealing with these American politicians saying now, we have to get rid of TikTok, oh my God, it's even okay if police beat up Ivy League, let's be honest, rich white kids, right, on these campuses, it means to tell you what the real politics are. It means to lay bare even the pretense of democracy. We live in a bizarre world where people talk about Putin's election was a farce, as if it's so easy to throw a farce election, because if it was, then they would have Zelensky do one, right? It's harder and harder these days to truly have a fake election. There's so many eyes on everything, especially when in a place like Russia, you get weeks and weeks to vote to make these kind of people. If an election can be so easily overturned, Zelensky wouldn't be running out his presidential term, still doing martial laws, extending the martial law, you know. And so that's where we are, right? The bad guys like Xi and like Putin are being elected. The good guys are creating reasons not to be elected or haven't been elected at all. Rishi Sunak, no one's ever voted for him. They voted for him to be in the House of Lords, but they did not vote for him to be the prime minister. That never happened. Britain never got to have a say in that. And this is a man that has the ability to take Britain in nuclear war. Like, think about it. This is an unelected official. In fact, there hasn't been an elected prime minister in Britain since Boris, which is, what, three prime ministers ago?
Who was impeached.
Should have made, in a democracy, that should have been immediate snap elections. The prime minister, we've lost faith in him. Who do the people want, right? Look at those things. I mean, in France with Macron, I mean, this dude has a favorability rating under 30%. They say now Biden is under 30%. I'm seeing polls as low as 18% of America. You, for some reason, the liberals don't like you. The leftists never liked you. The Republicans don't like you, even though you've built more of Trump's wall than Trump and deported more non-white people than Trump. Because, again, let's be honest. Lots of Ukrainians are coming into the United States. And they're being nationalized at an alarming speed. And you have to ask yourself, what type of cultural tie do they have to the Americans that would be stronger than, say, someone from Central America, where America is at least nominally part of the continent they come from?
Yeah, or share a border, perhaps.
Right? What would give a Ukrainian a bigger right to America than any Mexican or Salvadorian? You know, or any place that's been destabilized by violence and war, often of which we have a bit of a hand in, you know, I mean, that should be step one, right? If you're destabilizing those places, you should want to take their people in. Only white supremacy gets in the way of doing that.
I want to ask you something about what President Biden said yesterday. He said that Hamas was motivated by ancient desires to eliminate Jews. This is after the anti-Semitism bill, I believe, passed. And what is he talking about? And so, what is this? Why would a president be saying this?
So I have to make a bit of a caveat for our viewers who may or may not know this. I am actually Jewish. Jewish does not equate to Zionist. Hopefully anyone savvy enough to watch our show can understand that. And so I want
all the Jewish students out for Palestine. All the Jews that are anti-Semitic,
self-hating Jews, right? We understand the logos, because that's what they are now. If everybody's saying the same thing, it's a logo, it's a slogan, and that's the slogan. So I just want to be careful when I answer this. But talking about the Palestinians they are the Philistines, right? The Philistines have an ancient tie to that land, but they have no ancient rivalry with the Khazar. The Khazar and the Philistines have no historical contact in any kind of significant way until the 20th century. So it's not possible for the Ashkenazi Khazars to have had an ancient grudge with the Palestinians. It's just not, you can't have a serious historical conversation about that.
Yeah, and it seems as if they're sort of continuing to like double down on this narrative that seems so easily like debunked, which is being pro-Palestine is somehow anti-Semitic. And now that, you know, this bill is being passed, it is an interesting time. What I think it was last week, we were watching one of the press briefings, and this was when Netanyahu had just talked about how there needs to be more police presence and more being done
and immediately
for the college with the protesters. And then basically he was trying to ask him, he was like, how did you feel about this? How did you feel, you know, that a foreign leader is telling your college students how to react? And, you know, he was unable to, the speaker was unable to say what the Biden administration felt about it. I mean, this feels like a pretty simple First Amendment right kind of vibe, right? What's going on with this?
I gotta say, right, the thing about Bibi Netanyahu, I try to look at world politicians dispassionately, right? No matter whatever my political viewpoints are, I try to gauge them on how effective they are as a politician. And that said, you have to look at Bibi as perhaps the most skillful politician of our age. I mean, you could make an argument for Putin, you could make an argument for Xi, but I think at the end of the day, it has to be Bibi Netanyahu. This is a person that has been in power since, dear God, George Bush. He's still here, right? Like, this is a person that didn't have any type of big military acclaim coming up. Like, Ariel Sharon was a general, you know, he was, and that's how he gained the love of the Israeli people. Bibi is just clever, right? Like, he waits until there's a peace deal signed by Hamas. People are dancing in the street of Rafah to engage Rafah. He also waits for the Met Gala, right? And has, you know, millions of dollars, maybe tens of millions of dollars of commercials about remember to be nice to Israelis, you know? Or at least Jewish people, right? Which, again, nominally muddies the water between what it is to be an Israeli and what it is to be Jewish. That's clever, right? That's whatever else in the world he is a patient person that moves with a deliberateness and an understanding of the pieces of the board. It seems to me the only major miscalculation he's made in, I don't know, the last decade would be the response of the Iranians, which were it not for the diligence of the British, the French, and the Americans all chipping in and spending something like $1.6 billion for one night of defense. Other than that miscalculation, I cannot remember the last time he was outplayed. I mean, this is a man that's facing potential jail time should he lose the prime ministership. I mean, he looks like the kind of person that can juggle razor. He can juggle like flaming swords dancing on a razor blade. That is Bibi.
Yeah. And that brings me, because we just were having this conversation, obviously, about so much money is being utilized or sent out for these foreign wars. We see now that the battle for Chasiv Yar is on, and we've been hearing a lot of this rhetoric of, oh well, if the equipment had just got there in time, is that accurate statement? I mean, Ukraine is getting destroyed here, right?
We've heard this more than once. Everybody says the exact same thing. And again, that's how you know it's a slogan. That's how you know it's a logo. I mean, if you were to look at the breakdown of that money, it's like $64 billion, but only $16 billion or so of that is for military aid, most of which still has to be created. Then from there, it has to be shipped from America to Europe, from Europe to, you know, ostensibly the Ukrainian border. Logistics is to see. Look, they say rookies talk tactics, experts talk logistics, right? You can't miracle $16 billion worth of tanks into a theater of war. You just can't. They're big. They're slow. They require all kinds of maintenance. They require fuel, right? So all of these things have to move with that stuff, right? And you're hearing 16 billion, and you think, oh, it's going to be 9,000 tanks. No, man, all of that stuff, it requires so much supporting material to go with that. $16 billion, while a huge amount of money, when it comes to military, that's not $16 billion worth of ammunition means something very different than $16 billion worth of military equipment, right? You can't even fire everything with everything. Everything's not meant to do that. So it's not like all of this is $16 billion of offense, right? Which is really what people think they're hearing. And they think it's $64 billion worth of offense, and it's really not. It still has to be made, still has to be shipped, still has to be snook onto the battlefield. There's only a couple of places this can go. Not even just getting into the country, but getting into the battlefield. That's a whole nother issue. Getting it into a country is one thing, but getting it to the actual battlefield, and again, people think about losing these things in very bland terms. Oh, you lost 10 tanks. Okay, you didn't lose 10 tanks. You lost 10 tanks and 10 tank crews. There's not everybody in the army can do the same thing. Not everybody in the military can do what an army can do. You know what I'm saying? So, like, some of the stuff, there's no amount of money that can replace. One, because you can't make it fast enough. Two, you can't get it to where it needs to be. Three, even if you could do one and two, you don't necessarily have personnel that can utilize it. The real weakness in Ukraine right now is personnel. No amount of money, no amount of weapons can fix that, especially not while Russia's electronic warfare capabilities are so good. Because if it's automated, right, there's no guarantee it's going to make it at all. It takes a man, on a human, on the ground, making decisions that only a human can make. And Ukraine ain't got many of those left.
Yeah, I was reading that the whole system that is used in like Western, modern Western weaponry and aircraft is so foreign culturally to like the systems that were used in Ukraine and those European areas. And the language barrier is also very intense because not only are you learning how to fly a very advanced and very complex aircraft, you are doing it in a foreign language, basically. And we already know that many of the Air Force pilots currently are not even getting enough training because it's just so expensive to run these F-35 programs and things like this. How does the West compensate for this? I'm just so confused.
By overcompensating rhetorically. I mean, some of these things can't be done, right? Again, the same way we were just talking about personnel, where the Air Force is even more complicated. Not everybody that can fly an F-16 can fly an F-14, can fly an F-15, can fly an F-22, can fly an F-35. These are all very different platforms, you know? I mean, think about it as a car. Yeah, you can drive your little Honda Torcel, sure. Can you drive right now a rally car? Can you drive a Ferrari, right? I like. All of these things have different handling capabilities and require a different skill set. And as you said, I just can't imagine there's a whole lot of top guns out there that can even teach somebody.
You know, no Tommy Cruise out there right now.
No Tommy Cruise can speak Ukrainian. You know, so right. Now you need one of two things. You need these Ukrainians to have a extremely good sense of the English language to understand what's being taught, or you need an instructor that is a top gun that can speak fluent Ukrainian. I mean, that again, just what are the odds you're going to have those things, you know? And let's do be honest, the F-16 is an old, old platform. So if you're talking about, I mean, it's from the 80s. We're saying Tommy Cruise, and it's very appropriate. The F-16, let put it like this. People make fun of the Iranian Air Force because it's presumed to be using the F-14. Well, the F-14 was in Top Gun, okay, and was considered to be the best platform we had in the 80s. The F-15 was there, and the F-14 was generally seen to be the better aircraft, right? So how are you going to find a pilot that's still good enough to teach. The kind of people that trained in that generation are not being trained in that anymore. They're being trained in I hope to God, as a taxpayer, they're being trained in F-22 and F-35, not these relics. I mean, you may as well be flying a Spitfire. I mean, it's, you know, oh, this is the world's best World War II Spitfire pilot. No one flies that stuff anymore. Certainly not in America. Not really.
I got one last one before we break out of here. I wanted to talk about this just specifically because we've been talking about aircraft, and we know China may have some of the best aircraft in the game. But the United States is still funding sort of the separatist group in Taiwan. What is the update on that? And how concerned, how close is this? It seems like it's, I remember, I forget it was, we always talk about her. When she was saying, the America can afford two wars. Oh, no problem. You know?
So that wouldn't have been Yellen. That would have been Victoria Nuland.
I think it was Yellen, but she was
saying it was Yellen.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She was saying that we could support two wars. So now we kind of already are because of Israel and now Ukraine. So now this is three wars. Is this sustainable for the United States to be funding this separatist movement in Taiwan?
The same reason China cannot defeat the United States militarily. It's the exact same reason the United States cannot defeat China militarily. We can have battles and we can escalate, and who knows where that escalation ladder leads. But if we were talking about the logistics issues for trying to get something to a big landlocked place like Ukraine, trying to move something across the biggest body of water in the world, like in significant portions, the problem is once a war begins with Taiwan, there is no real way to see to their logistics at all. So what Taiwan has is pretty much what they're going to have, because the blockade of Taiwan would happen within 24 hours. Any type of serious response would have to take 48 to 72 hours, you know, unless you just sail into harm's way. Like, hopefully you're coming up with a plan. You're going to need packages to think about what's the escalation ladder look like, how far you're willing to go. And at this point, you don't know what your enemy's bottom line is. China has said several times, Taiwan is the first red line you must not cross. The United States, at least according to paper, recognizes there's a one China. And so the whole dealing with this is duplicitous in that one wouldn't have to struggle very hard to figure out how America would react to Puerto Rico trading arms with the Chinese. I mean, that wouldn't be hard to figure out. It's this big do as I say, not as I do type of foreign policy. And that's really the crux. Like
rules-based order.
All of these conflicts are coming from because people are following the rules. And now those rules can adversely be used against the United States. And the United States is saying, well, it has no jurisdiction. I mean, you have the ICC receiving threats from Congress people. I mean, imagine what would happen. Look, we're inner city left. I have friends that have seen the other side of the penal colony, that have been human labor, that are human slaves forever. And I cannot imagine what the consequences would have been if anybody in my neighborhood would have sent a threatening letter to the judge before a verdict came out. I'm pretty sure marshals would show up at least. And that's probably the best case scenario, right? So now you have American senators issuing threatening letters saying you've been warned. I mean, there's no judge in the world that would take that language, right? But that's who we are. The rules don't apply. When the ICC made a ruling against Putin, they were the greatest organization ever, right? But now they're about to rule against the most skillful politician the world has ever seen, and he pulls one more card out. This is my senator card.
Yeah, and I think that sort of goes all into the idea that, you know, so much of, you know, Congress is sort of bought and sold by AIPAC, and there's, you know, just another reason to continue to escalate on you know, police funding, you know, mass incarceration, like you said, because of, you know, free labor, you know, essentially enslavement, you know, obviously the 13th Amendment documentary, something that people can watch on that. And, you know, I think overall in general, we're seeing just a surge in, you know, people sort of the same people that were in Ferguson that were being, you know, identified sort of by, you know, state forces and things like that. We're seeing that happen now as well on the college campuses. And I think it's, you know, it's alarming. It's concerning, especially because it's so difficult to get the media that we want from mainstream media, which is, you know, obviously why we're here. I just wanted to also mention that we have some cool Inner City Left shirts. You know, you can get these by following us on our Patreon. Any thoughts before we got out of here, Tanky?
Power conceives nothing without a struggle. You know, that's Frederick Douglass. We have to look to the activists that came before, draw upon their lessons, stay woke. You know, it's funny that we live in a world where being woke has become a punchline. Go to sleep. I mean, but these are also the red pillars, you know. Oh, I've been woke. Red pill. Make it
Yeah. Make sense. Yeah. All right. Peace. We out.